Welcome, members and guests, to the March 7th program of the City Club of Eugene. Welcome to our TV audiences on community television and the Oregon Wind Network. I'm Marty Wilde, City Club President. Today's sponsors are Sacred Earth Botanicals, Driving Solutions Oregon, specializing in the evaluation and training of the older driver and person with a disability. And a special thank you to KLCC for airing the programs on Monday night and KPFF Consulting Engineers for our office space. We thank you for listening. These programs are free for our listening audience, yet there are costs involved. Your contribution is completely tax deductible and will help keep our organization healthy. Memberships are tax deductible. If you choose to make a matching donation to the Oregon Cultural Trust, you will help ensure the future of the arts in Oregon, including organizations like the Eugene Opera. Today's presenters are Mark Bodert, the General Director of the Eugene Opera and the Director of the Opera Notre Dame, University of Notre Dame, and Emily Pulley, Metropolitan Opera Soprano, who will discuss the Girl of the Golden West, Strong Women in the Gold Rush Era. Tomorrow is the International Women's Day, and how fitting for us to hear about a Eugene Opera heroine appropriate for the occasion. Minnie is a bold and independent saloon keeper in Puccini's most innovative opera, The Girl of the Golden West. Minnie's bar is in a miner's camp during California's gold rush in the mid-19th century. Director Mark Bodert and soprano Emily Pulley will discuss the character of Minnie, why she captured the imagination of opera lovers around the world, and how she speaks to us today. Please welcome them to the City Club of Eugene.
I'm going to start with a little history. If you don't mind, I'll put on my professorial mode. Before I start, what I want to say is that I said to someone recently that Girl of the Golden West is sort of looked at as Puccini's problem opera. I'll tell you why in a minute, but I've come to the conclusion that a problem opera is like a problem child. It's an opera that you don't understand yet. I don't think we quite get it yet. I don't think we're quite where Mr. Puccini wanted us to be, or he was 105 years ago. Puccini's career, he wrote two operas you never heard of. One is called Le Villi, and the other is called Edgar. And I'm right? You've never heard of those operas. I don't even think Puccini's mother heard of those operas. They did not do well, which is why you have not heard of those operas. He, like Puccini, like Bach, this is not very well known, but he comes from a family like the Bachs, a family of musicians, generations of musicians. So he had two operas that nobody ever heard of, and it became 1893, and he said, I think I'd like this to change. And he got a hold of a libretto of the story Manon Lescaut, the French book, and which had already been taken and made into an opera called, oddly enough, Manon by Massenet. And he said, I'm going all out. And he did. He went all out, and he had a success. And by going all out, I think Manon Lescaut is, every page is white hot. He kept nothing in reserve. I've always felt that about that opera. And it worked. I don't know whether he ever let himself be seen that much again. The next opera, that was 1893, the next opera was La Bohème. And we all know La Bohème. And that was, of course, a moderate success. That was irony. La Bohème is, if it's not the most popular opera in the world, it's in the top two. And then he wrote Tosca in 1900. And then he wrote Madame Butterfly in 1904. Now, it's interesting, and we know these, right? Bohème. How many people have seen Bohème, La Bohème? Lord knows we do it here, because it's a great opera. How many people have seen Tosca? Okay. But Bohème, right? We know. We love Bohème. It makes us cry. I had a conductor once say to me, no matter the quality of the 2.5 hours preceding the last page of La Boheme, the last page of La Boheme will leave you in tears, and that is the truth. Puccini was a very dangerous man. He was able in music to go right past our defenses. And he was able for a lot of that time to do it without exposing himself. This is all editorial comment from yours truly. Manon Lescaut, he put himself out there. Boheme, it's all really controlled. It's a very, you know, for the singer, it's like, it's not Verdi. Verdi will give you, you know, you want a little space here, take it. Puccini's like, no. Very, very, there's every inch of a Puccini opera is worked over by him. We do it the way he wants it to. And that's good. It's a good way. There was a little controversy. So almost everybody's heard La Boheme. Can you remember how the beginning of La Boheme? I'm not going to sing it to you. Right, exactly so. If I had the ability, I would show you a video of a performance of La Boheme. And you will see what we see from the stage, which is the conductor goes, we all go, yep. The conductor goes, boom, and there is 3 nanoseconds of total chaos. Because what happens is he gives the downbeat, and then the basses go, 1, 2, 3, 4, the basses play 4 notes. And he does his second beat when the basses say, we're done. But that can't be predicted. That cannot be predicted. So what happens is the conductor starts off La Boheme, and we are totally out of control for the briefest period of time. And then if you really listen to the beginning of La Boheme, I would say it's a good 12 or 13 seconds before we go like, okay, we know where we are. It's really amazing. It's really amazing. We don't recognize this anymore because La Boheme starts and we go, oh, that's La Boheme. We know how this goes. We know what it is. But my firm belief is that in 1896 in Turin, that opera started and everybody went, what are you doing? What are you doing? So La Boheme goes on, and think, if you will, and I'm not making a poll here, but hands of who went to Traviata in December? Who saw our Traviata? Traviata by Verdi is another one on the top 10, right? Great opera, but it's a different animal. Traviata is what we in the biz call a number opera, right? Number one, overture. Actually, overture is separate. Number one, introductory chorus. Number two, this. Number three, that, aria. And if you think about La Boheme, if you think about the soprano aria in La Boheme, great scene, revolutionary scene, but it actually harkens back to a four-part scena that is, you know, a history of opera, blah, blah. This would be now musicology. It is, the revolutionary part is that Verdi takes established forms and does something different with them, but they're still the established forms. A form is, I'll tell you a song that has form that you will know. Any 32-bar American standard. The one I'm using these days is You Can't Take That Away From Me by Gershwin, right? They Can't Take That Away From Me. You all know that song? That's an American 32-bar song. You know what I'm talking about? Eight bars. Those 8 bars are repeated. There's a bridge of 8 bars, and then we go back to the first 8 bars. That is form in American music. Form is what distinguishes classical music. Classical music is all about form. So the opera aria in Traviata is edgy, but there's form, and it's recognizable, and it ends, and we're good. It ends, we have a lot of applause, and then everybody goes, I'm happy. Puccini starts with this chaos, and then the opera goes on, and we come to, I have to say it first, the tenor aria. Tenor is first. I say this because I'm a tenor. And the tenor aria starts, and we know it now. We go like, oh, there's the tenor aria. But it's not like, here's an aria. It's all talky. And then he does a little bit of sustained singing, then he goes back and he talks. And then he does, you know, more, a little bit more, a little bit more. Then he sings, we hope, a high C on a good day, right? And then we go like, that's it, right? We can applaud. No. We have the high C, and then at the end he talks some more, and then it just sort of stops. And it stops in a moment that says, clearly, I mean, he says, like, over to you. So tell me your story, right? So when we excerpt this aria, it's kind of like taking a Shakespeare monologue and stopping in the middle. Right? This is not a number opera. This is kind of revolutionary. And people at the time went, Giacomo, what are you doing? I mean, it's the same thing with Mimi's aria. Mimi talks. He says, what's your story like? And she says, I do this, I do that, I do that. And at some point, it like broadens out into that heart-stopping Ma quando viene lo sgelo, right? And then at the end, she goes, oh, sorry, I talked too long. I didn't mean to take your time. Which is not the ending of a Verdi opera, aria. There's no high note, there's no nothing. It just sort of dribbles off. We're now familiar with this. So we go, okay, this is an aria. But again, the people of those time, at that time, it's like, what? So Bohème was accepted. Tosca was okay. Butterfly, it's not generally known. Puccini had a huge issues with Butterfly. Butterfly premiered in 1904, and everybody went, this opera stinks. We hate it. They threw things. Really, it was not split audience decision like, say, Rite of Spring. It was negative in Brescia in 1904. Puccini goes, okay, back to the drawing board. And he massages Madame Butterfly for 3 years. He spends another 3 years massaging it. It goes through a number of versions. And finally, in 1907, he gets it right. And it becomes Madame Butterfly that we know today. Have you done any of the... Yeah, I've done the original version. It's different, all right? But there's that process that we don't remember. So in 1907, Butterfly is good. We're all happy with it. Puccini brings it to New York, and it premieres at the Metropolitan Opera. He goes to the theater because there's a play by a producer and director and playwright and novelist and all-around theater person named David Belasco. David Belasco was the person who adapted the short story that became Madame Butterfly. So Belasco and Puccini already knew each other. Puccini's in New York. Belasco says, come to the theater. Puccini says, no problem. Goes to the theater, sees Girl of the Golden West. Now, the story is Puccini walks in, sees Girl of the Golden West, and comes out and says something like, he would say this in Italian, and you will know this, why? Because I tell you this. He says, I don't speak any English, but I like that so much I'm going to write an opera on it. Now, I have to tell you, I think that story is nonsense. I mean, it makes that Puccini to be like this sort of idiot. I don't know. I'm sure, I don't think he said that. But I know what he did, which was he said, I want that property. And he used it for the subject of the opera that became Girl of the Golden West. And he spent the next 3 years of his life working with that property. It was the first premiere at the Metropolitan. It was premiered in 1910, December 1910. And it began, and everybody went, we don't know what you're doing. This is a problem child. Because I think because they were all expecting something different. I think because of the publicity at the Metropolitan, that they were expecting an American opera, whatever that might be. Probably heavy Stephen Foster and John Philip Sousa. But they didn't get that. They got Puccini. They got Puccini. It's an opera that, musically, it's something we call through composed, which means that it's like Bohème in that it's got a lot, we talk and then we do a little aria stuff and then we go on and we talk some more and maybe a little aria and talk some more and the applause is at the end of the curtain, at the end of the act. It's not aria, applause, let's go on. It's through composed, which makes Belasco a really good companion for Puccini because Belasco is doing naturalism, natural dialogue, natural scenery, as opposed to something that is, quote, artifice, close quote. Puccini, you will hear from the beginning that Puccini keeps us off balance. I draw your attention. First of all, I would, as a member of your community, I strongly urge you to go and see Girl of the Golden West for any number of reasons, but most of all, because you will be blown away. Andrew Bezance, who you know, our music director, turned to me the first day I was at rehearsals, and he said, I think this is the best thing we've ever done. And I said, you know what? I think you're right. Emily is fantastic. Raul Melo is fantastic. Aaron St. Clair Nicholson, who plays the Sheriff Jack Rance, the same. Very strong cast. This is an opera that puts us on our side of the footlights on fire, in the good way. Puccini will keep you off balance from the very beginning. You will have to pay attention, but I assure you, it will be worth it. The story takes place in the American West, Gold Rush, California. Emily's going to talk a little bit about Minnie, the character, an unfortunate name now, right, because of Walt Disney, but let's get past that. Okay. I've said to, in other contexts, she's sort of like Marion Ravenswood, Ravenscroft in Raiders of the Lost Ark, Karen Allen in the first Raiders. You know, she runs the saloon. She can drink anybody up under the table, that sort of thing. She has a great entrance, one of the great entrances in all theater. There's a fight that breaks out on stage. Bottles are being smashed. Chairs are being thrown. So she comes on and shoots off a gun, which does get everyone's attention, including yours. That's a great, great entrance. It's the story is a love triangle. You've met the mysterious Dick Johnson before,
yes,
right?
Yes, we met. I was on a vacation in Monterey.
Right.
And we met, and then he invited me to go, you know, go off into the woods with him. And I said, yeah, I didn't show up. I didn't go. And she went on her way. But she's always wondered about him. And when they first, I know. Never go blueberry picking on the first date.
With a tenor.
With a tenor. But she's very happy to see him when he shows up at the polka.
He shows up in Act One. He comes in. As we go on, we see that there's something between these two people. And that is also seen by the sheriff, Rance, who is a very interesting, tragic character. He's tragic because he's a rough man. And with that, there is a side of sensitivity to him. And that side knows, is attracted to Minnie, is in love with Minnie. And it's also strong enough, that sensitivity is strong enough, that when Dick Johnson walks in the room, Rance knows that that's it. That he will not have, that Minnie is not for him. And that's tough. That is tough. I do want you to talk a little bit about her, if you would. Just looking at her from a guy's point of view, she's totally ununderstandable until you meet people who are like that. And once you do, you go, right. Very strong. Very hard to sum up. Self-directed. Private. Warm. And a waiter. Someone who waits. So it's a good character. And Rance, I think, is understandable. I have to say, it being still, this is hard for a tenor to admit, but I'm not quite there with Dick Johnson, Ramirez. As I said, the opera is set in Gold Rush, California. I'm sorry, this is professorial rambling. You will notice in Act Two that there are Native Americans. Warning. This opera was written in 1910, and the play was written in 1907. The treatment of Native Americans is not respectful. In fact, they communicate by using the word ugh, and I'm not making this up. Believe me, it will be respectfully and tastefully and very wonderfully handled by our artists. But I think a lot of the literature about Girl of the Golden West goes immediately to those characters. and says, this is about Westerners displacing Native Americans. And that is not the case. What this opera is about is much, much more complex than that. And the Native Americans are peripheral. They've already been displaced. This opera is about the clash of two cultures. One is the established Hispanic aristocracy in California, and that has been under pressure. And the other is the incoming Anglos, who have kept them under tremendous pressure for a period of time, and as a matter of fact, are sort of shoving their way into the area. Ramirez, Dick Johnson, a.k.a. his real name is Ramirez, he is a representative of that aristocracy, and his family has been working with powers in Europe to try and stabilize the situation and not have the landed people, the gentry who were there, not have them be destroyed, ground into the dust. He is reduced, in the course of this, things have gotten so bad that he is now reduced to outright lawlessness. And that is the only way that he can survive. It's a complex story. It's a complex story. And it's one that its complexity makes it alive today, and that quality of being alive is reflected in the music because we haven't figured it out yet. We're still figuring things like this out. I'm making no overt statements to modern society, but you know what I'm saying? It's the story is alive because it isn't settled. The story is alive because Minnie doesn't die at the end of the opera. It's in some sense, this is a joke, but you know, it's Mimi dies, we're done. We cry, we go home. It's over. That story is over. Here we have people literally ride into the sunset, which is all warm and fuzzy, but that riding into the sunset also means they are riding to something, which means there will be a sunset means that there will be an accompanying sunrise. And that feeling at the end of the opera is ambiguous, wonderfully alive and ambiguous. And in some senses, maybe that's what makes this opera unlike any other. You want to do some mini talk? Yeah.
Ever since I first saw the opera in music history class, I had a very strong desire to portray this character. I think she is the greatest heroine in all of opera. And some of that is because I'm originally from Texas, and we have a lot of strong women in Texas. But I remember thinking, if I had lived in that time and place, I hope I would have been someone like Minnie. I think she's just that. She is, to these minors, she is mother, sister, friend, nursemaid, confidant, teacher, confessor, everything. And you're in this incredibly harsh climate. I don't know if any of you have been to some of the old mining towns. I've worked a lot in Central City, Colorado, and there's a certain melancholy that's still there, you know, over 100 years later, of people who come to this place, this wild place, thinking that their lives are going to be completely transformed. They're going to strike it rich. And the sadness and the disappointment and the loneliness is just still palpable, I think. And Minnie is, for a lot of these miners, she is the one bright spot in their lives. And you get to see that. For me, what the opera is about, it's all about me. No, for me, the opera is about redemption. And the first thing you hear, the opening chord, which is this very sort of exotic sounding augmented chord. The theme is bum 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 bum. And you hear that shortly thereafter when Minnie does a reading of Psalm 50 to the miners. When she says, you know, purge me with hyssop and I'll be clean, create in me a clean heart. Very good for this time of year. And she explains it to him. She says, that's to say, boys, that you'll never find in all the world someone to whom a path of redemption isn't open. And this is tested when she finds out about who this man, this mysterious stranger whom she's fallen in love with, when she finds out who he really is. And the rubber sort of meets the road. She has to decide, well, can this person be, because he says, this isn't the life I wanted for myself. I really had hoped that I would be able to run away with you and find to some far-off place and live a life of peace and joy. And Minnie has to decide, well, can this outlaw who, you know, never mind the fact that he's been stealing gold from these miners who are just trying to collect enough gold to send back home to their families and that sort of stuff, but there have been, you know, these outlaws have killed people, and whether or not Dick Johnson was the person who did that, he's absolutely the enemy to all of these miners in the camp. And the thing that's so beautiful in the final scene is Minnie reminds all of these miners of what she taught them. And, you know, I've been all these things to you. Now you need to give me this man. And it's a beautiful story, and I think it is very telling that they go riding off. I think it's dawn, so I guess they go riding off into the sunrise. But it is, they go riding off into hope. But it's a melancholy, because it's a combination of both hope and watching the light in their lives disappear out of their lives, and but being willing to make that sacrifice for her happiness. So. It's such a beautiful story to me, and the characters. One of the things that I love about this opera is that it is, you know, the Old West is our mythology. It's familiar to us because I've been showing this picture. I'm so proud of my great grandfather was a sheriff in the Oklahoma Territories, and I have this great picture of him on his horse with his gun. And it's just like it's so wonderful. And I remember seeing it and thinking, oh my gosh, that's my sweet little grandmother's daddy. And so it's just a few generations removed. And Mark and I were talking about this the other day, that I think one of the things that was hard about this piece is that we weren't far enough removed from the Old West to have that nostalgia that we have for it now. So this piece really evokes that nostalgia, I think, and the fact that it is filled with sort of the fact that it's set at the end of the gold rush, when things were starting to go downhill and all these dreams were sort of starting to die out. And so it has that very, it's a happy ending, because, you know, they don't die, but it's sad, and I think it's reminiscent of us kind of losing that sort of romanticized notion of the Old West as well. But because it is both exotic and familiar at the same time, I find it very moving. And the fact that Puccini wrote these tunes that so many composers for the Westerns and for things like that drew upon, it's mind-blowing that Puccini wrote them first. And so some of the things that, and it's, they're so Western sounding, and for me, being from a place like Texas, it kind of stirs something in my heart. And you know, Puccini's my favorite composer anyway, so the combination of that wide open space sort of sound, and then you combine it with just the innovation and the just the sense of melody that Puccini had, and it just takes you to a place that I think no other, in my opinion, no other composer and no other opera can take you.
What Emily is saying is true, that, and again, this is, it takes some realizing on our part, is that we sort of know how the West sounds, don't we? I think we probably have an idea. It has something to do with French horns and, you know, sweeping things and that sort of thing. That pretty much comes out of this piece. There's Copland did it too, and he does it in a different way. But this piece defined the American West in sound. And it was remembered when it came time to do the great Westerns in the 40s and the 50s with those wonderful soundtracks by Waxman and people like that, the scores. They didn't have to invent the sound of the West. It had already been done by Puccini in this opera. I'll give you a little context then for what's happening over the next couple of days to wrap up the last 6 weeks of events around this opera, and then for a moment then touch on our place in the community. There is a gentleman by the name of Tony Meyer, who's sitting right there, a member of our board, has pioneered for us an approach to opera. This is now the third time that we've done it. We first did it with Nixon in China. There were, as you recall, 2 months of events around the 40th anniversary of the historical visit of Nixon to China. There were 4 productions of Nixon in China in the season that we did ours, and that was, and no one made anything out of it. No one made anything out of the fact that it was the same season that it was 40 years to, in our case, almost the day that Nixon actually went to China. I thought that was significant. I thought it was great for our community. I thought it was great for opera. We did it last year, as you know, with Dead Man Walking. That was Sponsors Inc.'s 40th anniversary. There was the conference at the university about prisons and peace. And then in the middle of it, or as part of all of this, we have Hege's opera. And now we have it with Girl of the Golden West, and next year we will have it with Sweeney Todd, and I hope we continue it into the future. If there have been times when our culture in America has gotten to the place that they can persuade themselves that opera is somehow ordinary, or, I hate to say this, easy. It isn't. It's hard. It's hard to do. It's hard to support. It tests everybody involved. Our performances, like performances everywhere, are made up of Benjamin Britten's Holy Triangle: composer, performer, and audience member. You're just as much as part of what we do as we are. And it's not what we do, it's what we all do. I think opera keeps us on our toes, keeps us on our toes in this community. That's a good thing. And it enriches us. It's a worthy effort. It's a worthy effort. Emily is representative of the type of singers we are now welcoming to our community. Emily is a distinguished international artist. She's one of the most experienced practitioners of the role of Minnie. She's here because what we offer is money and in kind. And in kind is coming to our community. In kind is being part of events like we have around this opera. In kind is working with Andrew Besance, our wonderful music director, and our chorus and local artists. And in kind is being here in Oregon. And I'm just so happy that this sort of thing is happening. I think I've said enough. We'll have questions in a minute. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to Eugene Opera Director Mark Boudère and soprano Emily Pulley. For those of you who missed her wonderful preview, you can get slightly less outstanding recordings on the content distributor of your choice. That would, of course, just be to whet your appetite for the performance next weekend on March 14th and 16th at the Holt Center.
You're tuned to KLCC Eugene 89.7 FM, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. We're also on the web at klcc.org.
Welcome back to the City Club of Eugene. We're here with Mark Boudère, who's the director of the Eugene Opera, as well as the lead singer, Emily Pulley, from their performance of Girl of the Golden West this weekend. I would like to announce, before we go to your questions, a few supporting events for the opera. That includes an ongoing exhibit at the Lane County Historical Museum, Women of the Gold Rush West, as well as a First Friday Art Walk tonight with Mark Boudère. I'm sorry.
I never took French. I took Spanish.
Smith. Mark Smith. Also playing this week, Once Upon a Time in the West at the Bijou Metro. I'm sorry. Also, March 8th, Eugene Public Library, 4 p.m., celebrating International Women's Day, a presentation on women of the Gold Rush era. March 14th, at the Knight Library Browsing Room at noon, a lecture, How the West Was Sung, Puccini, Colonialism, and Portrayals of American Indians. Again, getting back to Mark's theme. And, of course, the performance itself on March 14th and 16th at the Holt Center of Girl of the Golden West. And now to your questions.
Susan Connolly, City Club member. Thank you both so much for coming. I am so happy to hear that Minnie doesn't die. I am really tired of the women always dying at the end.
Me too.
Yeah, I bet. My question is, could you tell us a little bit about the sets and the costumes? From the photographs, they looked good, but I'd like to hear a little bit more.
The costumes are a production of a group of costumes that we have rented from a very distinguished costuming house called Malabar in Toronto. The sets are a sort of, well, you'll see them. They're at once, I think, impressionistic and real. We have things that they've all been locally assembled. And there you go. Does that help? This is a kind of different production than we've had. She wanted to know if they were extensive or bare boned. I have not seen the completed set. This will not be a production where you come out humming the sets. It's a little more than that, but we're happy with it. I think it's the thing that should be done. There were some treatments that we rejected. One of them was the treatment that we had for Traviata, which is the way opera used to be done, the painted flats, which for Traviata I thought was appropriate. This is the type of thing that focuses your attention on the drama.
Well, they're kind of cool because they're a little bit of both as far as they're very realistic in the foreground and very sort of impressionistic in the background. So it lets you, again, the fact that this is a familiar thing, it lets you fill in the blank. And the set itself, I think, is pretty atmospheric.
Yes.
And so, you know, you'll have a window that you know is a window, but it's sort of so I think it's one of those things that you can do for an audience that you trust, as far as you know that they will fill in the blank, but the tables and the chairs and everything like that are very authentic. So you have realism and then sort of impressionism in back of it, which I think works really well for a piece like this, because that's sort of musically, it sort of does the same thing.
And I think this was put together in consultation with our director David Lefkowitz, who worked on a very famous production that Emily did at Glimmer Class, and that was the same sort of thing, a mixture of realism and impressionism. I want to say something about Minnie not dying. You know, there's something about which I'm all in favor of Minnie not dying, I was thinking about this, and Puccini heroines, right? Minnie is like, oh, Puccini hates women because he kills them off. But, you know,
he loved them.
Well, he does, and all of Puccini's heroines support themselves.
Yep, in one way or another.
They do. I mean, even Madame Butterfly, right, who's supposed to be this... I mean, one laments her outcome. But, you know, she kept that household going for 3 years. That's strong.
Well, they all remain. The thing that I love about the Puccini heroines is they all remain true to themselves. I remember when I did Mimi here 3 years ago. 3 years ago, I never completely understood Mimi until I did Merry Widow. How many of you have seen Merry Widow? You know, are you familiar with that? You remember the grisettes, lo lo do do, clo clo, juju, and I was like, oh, Mimi, that's her grisette name. That's her. Streetwalker name, Mimi. So she sings that opening aria, Mi chiamano Mimi. They call me Mimi, my mio nome Lucia, but this is who I really am. I'm really Lucia. And so all of these characters, Tosca and Madama Butterfly, and they all remain true to who they are. And, you know, the situation that they're in is usually what leads to their death, be it consumption or that they, you know, they have no alternative, having their child taken away from them or something like that. But the women, rather than becoming something that they're not, you know, death is more often the result of the situation that they're in and not taking an easy way out, I think. Yeah.
Glad to say no sopranos were harmed during the making of this opera.
Alice Davenport, City Club member since 2008. From the musical, emotional, and physical standpoint, this is a question for the soprano lead. What's the most challenging scene in this opera for you?
That's a great question.
Not just the music, but the whole reign.
Well, the second act, once you're on, you're on. You get to go off for a very fast costume change, and it's some of the most beautiful music in the whole second act. You're like, why do I never hear that? Oh, that's right, because this is what's going on with me backstage. So, probably, vocally, there's some stuff that just the fact that it doesn't really relent, that you are, and it's, you're having all these emotional moments as more and more is revealed in the second act, more about Ramirez, and then with Rance and all this stuff. And so I remember one time when I was doing the understudy run-through at the Met of Traviata, and the prompter, there's this wonderful vocal coach named Joan Dorneman, and I've known her ever since I was doing the Met auditions up there. And she just slid me this note in the middle of the third act, and I opened it up, and it said, "Don't sing angry." And there's something, you know, about making sure that all the emotion is coming through, but that it's not affecting your singing, because you don't want it to be, you know, that artificial, you know. But you can't do, you know, you have to make sure that there's a balance, that your intent is there, but that it doesn't affect your singing. And that's really hard, because the second act is really emotional, as is the first act and the third act. So... But one of the nice things about this role is, unlike Tosca and Butterfly, it's because it is so conversational, you do get a chance to regroup. You know, you'll have some super high stuff, and then you get a chance to talk a little bit before you have to launch into the next long stretch of singing. And I'm also very graceful. So.
Stu Thomas, City Club member. And I have a question, but first a comment. You mentioned someone mentioned the movie Day in the Life of the West. Well, you may not die in this, but that movie is the only movie that I've ever seen where Henry Fonda plays a bad guy.
Mm. It works so well,
really,
doesn't it?
It's really interesting,
yeah.
My question, though, really, or our table's question was, how was this opera received in Europe, in Italy?
Oh, yeah, I have, you know, that's very interesting. I have some research to do on this. I know that the opera, the opening night at the Met was rapturously received, and then after that, it didn't seem to.
Yeah.
I think people went like, "We don't know what you're doing," and so it's been even there. It's been there's an opera called Turandot. I don't know if you know that, by. Obviously by Puccini, right? That opera, actually, before 1960, was kind of in the same boat as this. It was done, but it wasn't really there. And then I think a combination of a particular soprano and a particular opera and a particular tenor and a particular conductor, mm-hmm. Nielsen, Corelli, Stokowski, at the Met in a new production in 1960, everyone went right. I'm not sure that moment for this opera has come quite yet.
One of the nice things is that the copyright is now expired on this in 2010, so it is actually getting performed more because you're not having to pay
right.
royalties.
Yeah.
And
right.
I'm happy to see that, because, you know, I like to see it getting, you know, more and more chance to play, because I think once people see it, they're hooked. But, you know, Puccini also shot himself in the foot a little bit with this. How appropriate for this opera. But he wanted, you know, he was in love with the, at least the idea of the American West.
And he specifies he wants three completely different sets, like on the scale of sort of Aida. And in the third act, that he wanted giant sequoias and like nine horses, you know. And Minnie, I get a great entrance in the first act, but I get a great entrance in the third act too. According to Puccini, I'm supposed to come riding in on a horse. And that's yet to happen. Keeping my fingers crossed. I think a lot of people were intimidated by that. And one of the things I liked about the production we did at Glimmerglass 10 years ago was it was scaled down. And so because of that, I think that the story became more present. And I think that that will be the case in this production as well, that the story, which is, you know, a great story, that it allows, it's not caught up in all of the peripheral aspects of it, and you can really fall in love with these characters.
Mary Layton, City Club member since 2006, and our overachieving table has two questions. One is in the career and technical education mode. That is, how many roles do you sing in a year?
Well, one keeps one's fingers crossed. It really depends on the year. For a full-time singer, which we all consider ourselves very fortunate to be, more and more you have to have more than one job. And so for those of us who are lucky enough to get to do this full-time, we're really happy if we get five roles a year. Most gigs will last about a month total, and so you have a month, and then sometimes the gigs, you know, line up right up next to each other, and sometimes you have entirely too much free time and you begin to doubt everything about yourself. Five or six is good. There was one season where I think I learned, oh my gosh, seven or eight completely new roles, and that was a bit much. You can't make other roles fall out of your head so that there's room for new ones. And so it's nice if you have a little bit of space in between, you know, jobs to so you're not, you know, overlapping on roles. But I think if you ask most singers, we'd all be very happy to say if we had, you know, five or six roles per year that we got to do.
Thanks. And the second question is from us, from the folks who watch odors more often than operas. Are there particular movies that we might, if we see this opera and the next time we see this favorite old Western, we would actually recognize the influence?
Oh, wow. I think you can hear it with a lot of, just about any of the big, especially European movie soundtrack composers. Even coming as far as Morricone, you know, he did The Mission and some of these big, wide-open sort of sounding things. I think that influence, you hear it. It's the thing is, when you hear it, you think, oh, yeah, I recognize that from such and such, but it's like, no, such and such came from this. That's the thing that keeps blowing my mind, is mm-hmm. that Puccini did it first. So
there is one famous musical moment in this opera. How many people are acquainted with Phantom of the Opera? So there are four bars in the Act One duet between the soprano and the tenor that you will be listening and listening and listening, and you'll go like, wait, what? Andrew Lloyd Webber saw them. He said, I like those. I'm going to take them home with me. And he took an X-Acto knife and cut them out of Girl of the Golden West and pasted it right into Phantom of the Opera. This was noted and commented on by the Puccini family. In court. But it's there's a place, boy, you're going to see influence for days.
Yeah.
Bob Cassidy, City Club member. Our table was interested in your competition, the Metropolitan Opera on Screen. What kind of effect has that had on the opera here or across the country? How has that aided or hindered?
Well, I have to say, any opera is good. I guess I'd say a couple of things. We have an issue now as a culture. Music that is not performed live and unamplified is two-dimensional because it's a physical thing. And I don't mean to be warm and fuzzy about saying this. This is physics, how sound is carried through the air. This is a tangible connection between the audience and the performer. I think if you look back on the great performers, the Liszts, the Caruso's, people like that, they understood this and they were able to use this somehow in their communication. The Met broadcasts are fantastic. Frankly, my understanding is that the Met itself is feeling an adverse reaction at the box office from their own. This is what I have heard from more than one source. I don't know Peter Gelb, so I can't say for sure, and I'm not sure he would tell me anyway. But I hear this. And it's a shame. What we have in Eugene, and I like to say this when we deal with the high school kids, is we have access to performance here that is cheaper and more accessible than any other place that I know. It's kind of amazing. You know the array of performing arts that we have in our town. You know the resident companies at the Hult. I know it's more than a movie ticket, but you know what? A balcony seat at the opera is, I think, a dollar. I think a balcony seat at Eugene Opera is $21, and I think what's the tariff at Cinemark? 22? And I don't know if any of you have lived in New York, but to get to the Metropolitan Opera is wonderful. It's also a pain in the neck. It's a long way. Parking is expensive. Once you park your car, it's a long way to get there. You have to pay the babysitter. You know what? I mean, all of this stuff. And the tickets are really, really expensive. If you go and see Emily at the Metropolitan Opera, I assure you, you will be paying more than you will next week. A lot more. So here, we've got the symphony, we've got the ballet, we've got the opera, we've got the Mozart players, we've got the concert choir, we've got the Bach Festival, we've got OFAM, we've got all this stuff. It is relatively affordable. You can go in your jeans, and, you know, it's like right across the street. People who grow up in this city will never, repeat signal, never have that ease and affordability ever again. It's something to be fostered. I mean, I think the broadcasts are great. Opera is singing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to be older than 22, to quote our tenor, to sing. I mean, I'll try and make this brief. There is, oldsters, my dinosaurs of my era. Anybody remember Omnibus, ABC, Sunday afternoons? Omnibus, okay? Leonard Bernstein. There's a program from 1957 called Why is Opera Grand? Those Omnibus programs have been released. They were on kinescopes. They've been released on DVD. And I know the text forever, and I finally saw it. He puts together a performance of Bohème, Act 3. And he does it in the Old Met. It's footage of what the Old Met looked like. The singers are Marcello Pobe, who was an okay Italian soprano. Boy, was that's like a college kid. Yeah, she was okay. She sang at the Metropolitan. Did you, Mark, sing at the Metropolitan? No. She was good. And it's Frank Guerrera and maybe Mary Costa as Musetta. And the door opens and Rodolfo comes in, and it is a baby Carlo Bergonzi.
Oh, wow.
Carlo Bergonzi, the great Italian tenor. And Carlo Bergonzi starts to do stuff. And I played it for my kids at Notre Dame, and they're going like, what is he doing? Because it's kabuki. It's stylized gestures. It's not unpleasant. But it's stylized gestures, and it's different than the other singers are doing. The other singers are trying to do TV acting, even back then. But I said to the kids, where is he looking? He's looking out front. Who is he looking at? The conductor and the audience. Where is his face pointed all the time? To the audience. That's what happens in opera. The person who sings looks at the audience. The person who's being sung to looks at the person who is singing. And the audience says, oh, they're having a conversation and I'm part of it. Mm-hmm. And then I said, listen to what he is doing. It is masterful, masterful singing. So at the end I said, you know, it's like I think people go, they go to the opera and they go like, I liked it, but all the singing, which is like going to the ballet saying, I love this story, but my God, could they stop dancing? Singing is the art form. Puccini is written for unamplified theaters. That's how it works. That's what it is. That's the thing. And we've got it here. It's not anything else. But what it is so fantastic.
Yeah. Amen. Sorry. I would add as a singer, I don't go to the broadcast just because, I mean, they're great, but they are a different art form. They once you have something in between the singer and the ears and the eyes, then it becomes a different art form because somebody else is tampering with it. And a colleague of mine put it really well. She goes, there's just something that's really special about knowing that you're all breathing the same air. It's even a line from the prologue to Pagliacci. We all breathe the same air. And it really is, you know, it sounds very artsy-fartsy to say it's a shared experience, but it is. And as a performer, you absolutely feel the energy in the room when it's with you. And it makes us better performers. And it's my job to bring you into my story and out of your own story for a while. And so hopefully when you return to your own story, you'll be slightly changed, you know, or you'll have, you know, a slightly different perspective. But it's about that communication and about telling the story. And we're so lucky that we have music. The music is the amplification of the story, you know, and... But it really is, I think, such a... And I think people notice it. I love it. When I did a career day, and the best thank you note I never got because the teacher thought I would be offended, but I think it was third grade, and somebody wrote me a note and said, Dear Miss Pulley, I liked your singing. It made me move back. And So, you know, the great thing is, and I saw a couple of you flinch over there with the surprise high note, but, you know, it does make you move back, and it does make you lean forward, and it does make your heart beat a little bit faster. And when you are in a live performance, you know, you are a part of that experience, and it's very different than sitting in a movie theater. It's a lot more active. And we appreciate it. We certainly love having you there, and knowing that you are an integral part to what we're doing on the stage is.
I want to take 45 seconds to sort of go forward with this. We love having you there. Don't get us wrong, but it's not warm and fuzzy. And please, please, please make no mistake about this. When you are at a live performance, you are a performer. I don't mean this in a metaphorical way. I'm not saying this to make you feel good. You come in and the thoughts that you think are what is happening in that room. And there is physical communication, I don't mean to be make anybody uncomfortable, going back and forth between you guys and the audience. Between you and us. Right?
Absolutely.
This is, for us, it's so obvious, I wonder why people don't talk about this more. When you go and you go to the Met, it's all well and good, but it doesn't involve you. When you go here, in a sense, what's happening on stage, it's not secondary, but we're all in the same room at the same time, and we can't ignore that. We're all there together. And that's the important thing. Wow.
Great.
Sound of music. Thank you, Mark Baudaire and Emily Pulley from the Eugene Opera for bringing clarity and vision to the City Club program on The Girl of the Golden West, Strong Women in the Gold Rush Era. Please go see it next March 14th and 16th at the Holt Center here in Eugene. Thanks again to our sponsors, Sacred Earth Botanicals, Driving Solutions Oregon, and KLCC. We meet next again on Friday, March 14th, here at the Downtown Athletic Club to hear a completely unrelated topic, Collaboration Corvallis, a project to manage the impacts of a university's growth, one that has some impact on our discussions, I would note, here in our town. Lunches for this program can be ordered on the City Club's website or by contacting the office. Thank you all for coming today.